Hello, and welcome to the Chris Yeh Podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh, and today is another banner day. I am joined by my old friend and professor emeritus at Harvard Business School, Richard Tedlow. We are doing our continuing series of discussion of the charismatic entrepreneurs of business history, and today we are talking about someone who, at one point, was the most famous person in the world, and that is Henry Ford. So Richard, when we think about Henry Ford, I think we need to go a little bit into the history of Ford and the state of the world as it existed when Henry began his entrepreneurial career, because I think it's very hard for people here in the 21st century to really understand what things were like back at the turn of the century. So help sketch the story, help lay out the picture of what it was like when Henry Ford was starting out.
Ford actually was, he was born on July 30th, 1863, which was the month that the Battle of Gettysburg was fought during the Civil War, and he lived until 1947. So he was born into a world of horses and buggies and wood piles, and he died out of a world which had atomic piles. I mean, that gives you some sort of idea of the incredible technological transformation that he lived through. And part of that, an important part of that, was putting America on wheels, which he, if you had to say what individual was most important in achieving that goal, it would be he. And in 1900, there was still a lot of doubt about, first of all, whether there would be automobiles. Secondly, and this is very important, how they would be, what the motive power would be. Would it be steam? Would it be electricity? Would it be internal combustion? And would it really replace the horse? A journalist writing in 1925, looking back to 1900, said that no prediction would have been less believed in 1900, that by 1925 there would be no horses in cities. In 1900, there were about 21 million horses in the United States. There were only about 76 million people. Hay was a major agricultural commodity for the horses. And if you look at what the United States, let's take a look at the country first, didn't have in 1900, you get a little feel for the hurdles that had to be jumped. The country didn't have improved roads. It didn't have gas stations. And in fact, it had very little gas. John D. Rockefeller was refining his petroleum into kerosene for lighting. There were no rules of the road. Nobody knew. There were no, traffic lights. No one knew who had rights of way. There were no parts distribution and repair shops, so if you got stuck someplace, you either had to fix the car yourself or you had a long walk ahead of you. And the whole financial infrastructure, which we take for granted today, it didn't exist. There was no GMAC. You couldn't borrow from a bank to buy a car. That was the world in 1900 as far as the country was concerned. As far as the early automobiles were concerned, they didn't have all-weather bodies. They didn't have headlights. So this is at a time in 1900 when most of the population lived in the north. Days were short in the winter. It was cold. So, I mean, obviously you couldn't use this thing for commuting. They didn't have turn signals. They didn't have self-starters. As a matter of fact, it was dangerous to start a car. I mean, one of the reasons that Charles Kettering invented the electric self-starter was that someone whom he knew had his neck broken when a car backfired when he was trying to start it, and the crank came up and hit him in the chin. They didn't have steering wheels even. They had tillers instead. And people think in terms of analogy. So, what has tillers? And the answer is yachts. And so cars were looking a little bit like playthings for the rich, not something that was going to be mass marketed for everybody. And the president of the Carriage Makers Association at the end of the 1990s said, you know, there have been 125 cars sold in the last 5 years in Manhattan, and there have been, you know, something like, I think, 350,000 automobiles, pardon me, carriages. And he said that the idea that the horse would someday be replaced by a mechanical device was a fallacy too absurd to be mentioned by intelligent men. So there were, you know, people who look around and are, most of us are marching backwards into the future. And, you know, they're seeing what was. They think it's going to be that way forever. Horses have been around forever. The country doesn't have an infrastructure for, you know, the cars that they saw on the road, which were few in number. And so if you were a betting person, you might not bet that there would ever be a mass marketed automobile in this country.
And Ford changed all that, but he wasn't the first person to build a commercial car company. Cars had been around, or automobiles or whatever they were called, had been around for some time at that point. So what was the early history of the automobile? And then what changed? What allowed Ford to make this big change?
They had been around for some time. A lot of people look at 1885 as being the year that Daimler first produced a Daimler. But when, and as a matter of fact, by 1900, there were already a couple of hundred people and fledgling car companies trying to get into the business. And as the great business historian Alfred D. Chandler Jr. said, 10 years of competition, 90 years of oligopoly. And that's exactly what happened in the automobile industry. The cars that were made not only in the United States but in Europe, and until 1908, France was the up until 1907, France was the leading automobile manufacturing nation in the world. Car companies usually made short runs of expensive cars because these could be put together by hand, and you could charge high margins. And that once again reinforced the idea that there would be they'd be a plaything for the rich. And Ford had a vision. He's been described as a man of vision and of visions. And he wanted to put America on wheels. And I'd like to quote, if I can find it quickly, what he said. These are his own words. I will build a car for the mass, for the great multitude, constructed of the best materials by the best men to be hired, after the simplest design that modern engineering can devise, so that no man making a good salary will be unable to own and enjoy with his family, to own a car, and enjoy with his family the blessing of hours of pleasure in God's great open spaces. So that was the vision. He wanted everybody to have access to a car, to enjoy with his family the blessing of hours of pleasure in God's great open spaces. And he kept to that. And it was that vision of making this available to everybody rather than making expensive ones available only to the rich. Woodrow Wilson, when he was president of Princeton in the early 1900s, was concerned that the automobile would bring on socialism because only the really rich people would be able to own it. Everybody wanted one, and the not only the poor but the middle class wouldn't be able to own it. And you know, Ford democratized the automobile.
Now, what's remarkable is the degree to which he democratized the automobile. So I think it may be hard for people to grasp just how rapid the rise and growth of Ford was, the Ford Motor Company, as well as the magnitude of his success and the dominance that Ford reached. So walk us through that. Just how big was the Ford Motor Company? How quickly did it grow?
Well, before actually getting to the Ford Motor Company itself, I let me say that, Henry Ford himself in a shed in back of his home in Detroit, where he was working for the Detroit Edison Company, put together a quadricycle. That was the first car that he ever built. And he built it himself from the ground up. I mean, this is a guy who really knew cars. He was a gifted mechanic. He could take watches apart and put them back together when he was very early in his teens. He 4 months after his mother died, he was very, very attached to her. He saw a steam-driven car, and so he wanted to build these himself. And he found, the first company he founded was the Detroit Automobile Company, and that was in 1899. That only lasted 2 years. The next one was the Henry Ford Company. That only lasted 2 years as well. Wound up becoming Cadillac, that company. And then finally, in June of 1903, that's when he founded the Ford Motor Company. So he had an experience not utterly different from today's entrepreneurs, which is he failed before he succeeded. And then once he had his own company, it wasn't strictly his own because he borrowed money and had partners, was not publicly traded. He still had to go through eight models before he found the one that he wanted. There was the A, the B, the C, the F, the K, the N, the R, and the S. And then finally he gets to the Model T. And the Model T, he's convinced, is going to be the device that's going to make his dream of a car for the common person come true. And the Model T premieres on October 1st, 1908. And from then on, I'm going to borrow your term with you and Reid Hoffman in your excellent book, Blitzscaling. From 1908 on, that's what he did. I mean, he thought, this is the product, and now I'm going to get big fast and ride the learning curve. And so the first Model T was available at $850. He wanted to push the price down. He got it down to $600. By 1924, it was selling for under $300 at a time. Basically, you could buy a Model T for half the price of a household refrigerator in 1924. He moved into, in 1910, into the Highland Park plant in Detroit. It was just slightly over 100 acres. And at the time, I mean, I've read that it was the largest manufacturing facility in the world. And then after that, he moved into something that was an order of magnitude bigger, which was the gigantic River Rouge plant south of Detroit. So he moved very fast, hired thousands of workers, invested a fortune from retained earnings and also from his partners, and didn't pay dividends, which becomes an issue. And then by 1921, he basically owns over 50% of the automobile market in the United States. And he became a billionaire once he found the product. And once he realized that, to use an automotive metaphor, this is the time to put the pedal to the metal, he did. And he swept all before him.
That's quite remarkable. If we think about that period of time, 1908 to 1921, it's basically just add, change the years. It's imagine the year 2008, the year 2021, or maybe 2007 and 2020. And that's where one of the interesting parallels come up. Because if you think about it, in our last conversation, we talked about Steve Jobs, who introduced the iPhone in 2007. And here we are 13 years later, and the iPhone really has changed the world and has been this dominant product, has helped propel Apple to being a trillion-dollar company. And it's that same remarkably short period of time that took Ford from founding of the company and creation of the Model T to owning over 50% of the automobile market in the United States of America. That's quite remarkable.
It is, and it's one of these situations in which the window closes very fast, very quickly. There was only one other domestic startup after, well, there were two. Well, to be clear, General Motors had been founded during the early 1900s, but it went bankrupt, basically, not formally, and it was bought out of bankruptcy in after World War I by the DuPont family. And then in 1925, Walter Chrysler put Chrysler and Dodge together and formed the Chrysler Corporation. And that was the last auto startup in the United States until Tesla, less successful one. It's not a two-sided market in the sense that people usually use that phrase, but it you really had to move fast and get the economies of scale, be able to sell at progressively lower prices. We talked about the charismatic man or woman as someone who stands at the edge of history and brings the future to the present. And that's what Ford did. I mean, that's as good a description of him as I think one can find.
And what's remarkable about this story, about Ford, about the dynamics of the industry, is it really is that illustration of blitzscaling you described. And not in the standard way, but it really was the case that there were tremendous competitive advantages you got from scale. And a lot of that was because the automobile was at the center of an entire ecosystem of related companies and services. And so the Model T, by achieving unprecedented scale, that meant that there were more people who understood how to actually repair or service a Model T. It meant that the parts for the Model T were readily available, both from directly with aftermarket manufacturers or Ford himself, as well as from used Model Ts that could be cannibalized in junkyards and the like. It basically becomes an entire ecosystem, and it becomes very difficult for someone to compete with that ecosystem. It's why it's a winner-take-most kind of market, at least to a certain point. I think that the analog I would look at here in the 21st century is if you look at these ride-hailing companies, again, the natural structure appears to be some sort of oligopoly, but it is not the kind of dominance that Ford had initially achieved with the Model T. Something was different about the Model T. It was the only time in history when someone achieved that kind of dominance with a single model of vehicle.
That's true. And that kind of dominance in an industry which, today has an immense amount of variety and a lot of overcapacity today. There are a couple of things that ought to be said about what Ford did once he moved into the Highland Park plant in 1910. In 1913, he introduced the moving assembly line into the various processes that were involved in putting a Model T together. And as a result, the chassis went on a moving assembly line in the fall of 1913. Prior to that, it took about 12 and a half hours to assemble a Model T chassis. By the spring of 1914, it took 1.5 hours. That's what the moving assembly line did. And that means that if you're still in the 12 and a half hour business, you're not in the business. Bill Gates, please correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that he said that the biggest mistake he made at Microsoft was not inventing Android. He believed that there was room only for one other operating system, and that was a $400 billion misstep. Now, luckily, he did for him, he did enough things right, so that was not a killer. But it turned into a duopoly, and the automobile industry in the United States turned into a three-company business, certainly by mid-1930s. But it's those remarkable breakthroughs, the moving assembly line, interchangeable parts, and I would add the $5 day, which made Ford world famous, which was introduced on January 5th, 1914. Those three things that makes it very, very, very difficult to compete with him. You know, his costs are the lowest. He's coming down the learning curve. He's willing to pay his people twice the oil manufacturing average. So how do you compete against this? The answer is with difficulty.
And this reveals, again, from a business model perspective, one of the key things, which is even at that point in time, his ability to reduce the amount of labor required to produce the vehicle allowed him to pay a premium for that labor because of that increased productivity.
That's correct. And that, you know, that was a, it was a, it was a virtuous circle, and it made that company a fortress.
Now I'm picturing this, the $5 day. This is something that may sound crazy to people who are living today, maybe who don't even remember a time before the iPhone, let alone a time before the automobile. But this $5 a day, which was the pay of the workers at the Ford plant, was revolutionary. I mean, if you think about it, it's like double the standard wage, which I guess it would be the equivalent of saying, hey, guess what? You were paid $50,000 a year before. I'm going to pay all my workers, all my assembly line workers, $100,000 a year. What was the impact it had?
It was overwhelming. And as a matter of fact, it was greater than Ford himself thought it was going to be. They only announced it to the newspapers, and it became worldwide. He became world famous as a result of this. Why? Well, not only did something like what you just said happen, you know, you used to be making $50,000 a year, you know, now you're going to make 100. This happened without your even asking to make 100. It happened with unorganized workers. There was no union. There was no strike. There was no violence. This was an age of industrial violence. He just took it upon himself to raise the wages of his workers in order to keep them. I mean, working on an assembly line is very hard for anybody who's ever done it. It's mind-numbing. But, you know, the next day, my recollection is they had to have fire hoses in the plant to keep people away from the gates who wanted to get in and work for $5 a day.
And that's the fact that he just did it is so remarkable. I mean, it would be as if just tomorrow Walmart announced it was doubling the wages for all of its workers without any explanation.
And without any pressure. Ford, in the early years, wrote his own rules, and this was all in the service of making that vision of a car for the common person come true. And if that meant paying your workers $5 a day, that was fine. If that meant not paying dividends, that was fine. It wasn't fine with all the shareholders. As a matter of fact, he was sued for not paying dividends by Horace and John Dodge, who of the Dodge brothers, who owned a part of the company. And that suit itself is a hell of a story.
Well, let's dive into that story. So the Dodge brothers, I think people understand the name Dodge in the context of automobiles, but I never knew that the Dodge brothers were part owners in the Ford Motor Company. How exactly did that happen, and what happened with this lawsuit?
Yeah, they wanted more money, not unlike a lot of other capitalists, and Ford didn't want to pay dividends. He wanted to plow the money back in and into the company. And this is an interesting moment. It took place in the lawsuit. The Dodge brothers sued Ford to give more, to pay higher dip, to pay something in the way of dividends. And so Ford took the stand. This was in 1916, 1917. And if you'll indulge me, I just want to read you a Q&A because it's a remarkable testament to what Ford viewed the purpose of the corporation as being. For him, he didn't work for the corporation. The corporation worked for him. It worked for him to make his vision come true. So the Dodge brothers lawyer said, you say you don't think it's right to make so much profits. What is this business being continued for, and why is it being enlarged? Answer, to do as much good as possible for everyone concerned. What do you mean by doing as much good as possible? Ford then replies, to make money and use it, give employment, and send out the car where people can use it. His cross-examiner accuses him as follows, is that all? Haven't you said that you had money enough yourself and that you were going to run the Ford Motor Company thereafter to employ just as many people as you could and give them the benefits of the high wages that you paid and give the public the benefits of a low-priced car. So he's accusing him of paying high wages and charging low prices, a vicious accusation. And the answer is, I suppose I have, and incidentally make money. Question, incidentally make money? Yes, sir. Question, but your controlling feature so far as your policy, since you've got all the money you want, is to employ a great army of men at high wages to reduce the selling price of your car so that a lot of people can buy it at a cheap price and give everybody a car that wants one. And then Ford replies, if you give all that, the money will fall into your hands. You can't get out of it. Ford lost that suit because the judge said that's not what a corporation is run for. It's run to make money and to make money for the stockholders. So Ford was forced to pay dividends. And since he owned the bulk of the shares, losing that suit made him richer, which is, I think, a good rule for any entrepreneur. If you lose a lawsuit, try to get richer as a result of that.
It's remarkable because a similar thing happened to John D. Rockefeller. He lost the antitrust action against Standard Oil, and the breakup of Standard Oil actually made him wealthier than ever.
Yes. He lost that suit in 1911, and actually the large parts of that company have come back together. I mean, Exxon was first Esso, Standard Oil of New Jersey. That was his company. That was allowed to merge with Exxon, which was ExxonMobil, created ExxonMobil. Mobil was before that Saucony Mobil, which was Standard Oil of New York. And those were both Rockefeller's companies. And now, of course, they're back together. But yeah, they were broken up, and he became immensely wealthier as a result of that. If I may be permitted a digression.
Please.
I had many wonderful moments for teaching at the Harvard Business School over 31 years. And at one time I had a direct descendant of John D. Rockefeller in my class. And we spent 2 days talking about Standard Oil because it's a long story. And before I delved into this subject, I said to this young man, look, we certainly would want to hear from you, but not till the end. Let's have the discussion, and then I'd really like you to take questions and answers. So Mark sat up on the sky deck on the highest row of seats, listened, and then took questions. And one of the questions was, what was it like the first time you saw Rockefeller Center? And he said, absolutely nothing. I thought everybody had a center. I thought there was a Yay Center. I thought there was a Ted Lowe Center. And this just happened to be a Rockefeller Center. And it happens to be like 13 acres in Midtown Manhattan. But, he was just a kid. And that was a wonderful moment because it allowed people to see the world through a Rockefeller's eyes. And seeing the world through Ford's eyes is not easy. Especially as he becomes wealthier and wealthier, and also he becomes an icon. He is truly a charismatic figure. People felt that they knew him in the same odd way that they felt like they knew Steve Jobs. They wrote letters to him. They wrote poems about the Model T. There were cartoons. There were at the Baker Library at the Harvard Business School. There's a cartoon book about the Model T Ford. I'll give you an example. John Dillinger, some of your listeners are doubtless too young to know this, but John Dillinger was a bank robber in the, died in 1934. So in the early 1930s. He would drive up to banks, take out his guns, rob the bank and then leave. That was his business model. And he wrote a letter to Henry Ford. I've actually seen this. It's just my recollection is it's addressed to just Henry Ford Dearborn, and they knew how to get it to him. And basically he says, I really love your cars. I often have to leave work in a hurry, and people eat my dust when I drive a Ford.
And, good endorsement. So, my goodness.
Well, it's impossible to imagine that being written to anybody else. I mean, any other auto executive or anybody else when it was written. So, as I say, people had the sense that they knew the guy. Quite odd.
And he really was this cultural figure. As I recall, didn't Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, instead of saying the year of our Lord, say the year of our Ford, because Henry That's Ford correct. Had been so influential?
He would talk about your Fordship instead of your Lordship. And the year of our Ford. And the name became synonymous with what a business corporation can do to liberate the common person, at least in its early years, in its glory years, before Ford lost his way and before the company lost his way. If he had died the day after the $5 day, we'd be looking back upon him as being some kind of miracle man who, if only he had lived longer, we'd be living in a better world. But unfortunately, for the sake of drama, I guess, he outlived the usefulness of his personality.
Well, we'll definitely have to get into that later phase of his life and career. That's for sure. It's a very important part of the story. But I guess before we move on from the $5 day, one of the things I've sometimes read, people from a strategy perspective would say, oh, this is brilliant strategy. By paying the higher wages, he's creating his own customers. Ford workers can afford to buy Fords. That never really seemed to make a lot of sense to me. Is this a real thing? Was that part of the reason why Ford did it? What were his motivations?
That's what people say. I remember asking in 1973, when I was working on something else, an expert on this, I said, you know, if you made $5 a day, could you afford a Model T? You know, some people could, some people couldn't. Some people bought them used. They lasted forever. My father bought a used one. His motivations were multifaceted. One was to keep people in the plant because it was mind-numbing work, and it was, you know, you were no longer an artisan. I mean, the early cars, criticized them though you might, as being playthings for the rich, you built them, you know, with a team of people. And the early Fords, I mean, if you look at the people Ford gathered around them, they were known as people for whom work was play. And if it hadn't been that way, they would have died because they, you know, they slept where they worked. That was certainly not true of an assembly line. So part of the reason that he paid that higher wage was so he didn't have to, you know, hire three times as many people as worked in the plant just to keep the plant running. He wanted people to stay. So that was one important reason. But another one, it makes it, as I say, it's a huge competitive advantage. If you can pay your workers twice as much as what everybody else can pay, they're going to work for you, and everybody else is going to get, you know, somebody, if they can get a worker, someone else. So
I'm reminded, I don't know if you watched the television show Mad Men, which is an AMC drama about an advertising man during the 1960s.
I must confess I didn't, but I worked as an office boy in an advertising agency in the 1960s, so I'm not unfamiliar with the world.
Oh my goodness. So you may want to check it out. It's a very famous television show. But in the show, there are a couple of key characters, one of whom is the protagonist, Don Draper, and the other of whom is a woman named Peggy Olson, who is a pioneer in the advertising industry who works for him. And at one point in time, she says, you know, how come you never appreciate me? I do all this great work and you don't thank me, you don't praise me. And Don Draper looks at her and says, that's what the money is for. Huh. And that strikes me as a very sort of Ford-like thing. The $5 day was Don Draper writ large, it sounds like. Is it a way of using the economic might of the company to fix a problem on the personnel side that was inherent in the system? Although, again, it sounds like part of it was also Ford just felt like it was a good thing to pay high wages to his workers.
That's right. He just felt those two are not mutually exclusive. He did it because he felt like it. He was he was an autodidact, self-taught, brilliant mechanical engineer, basically. And, he didn't get an MBA. He didn't graduate in the top 5% of his business school class the way you did. But he just had instincts. And he acted on his instincts. And for the first years of the Ford Motor Company, those instincts served him very, very well. The idea that that the lower the price of the car, the greater the market would be, the greater the market is, the more you're going to ride the learning curve. And all of a sudden, you have a way of doing business which... Alfred P. Sloan Jr., who was the great figure in General Motors, who the DuPont family put in charge of General Motors in 1923, said, we could not compete against Ford on his own basis. Nobody would take more capital than existed in the U.S. Treasury. So we had to find a different way to compete. And they did. I mean, they came up with the annual model change and something that they called the car for every person purpose. The Chevrolet, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Buick, and Cadillac, whereas Ford was kept producing the Model T. And they also came up with the annual model change, and Ford didn't have that. Ford's, my recollection is that the average Model T produced in, say, 1923 or 1924 lasted 7 years. And one of Ford's problems was, how do you compete against your own used cars when they never wear out?
So your father, you mentioned, bought as a car a used Model T. When did he buy it? How much did it cost him?
It was in the 1930s. So the Model T was discontinued in 1927. It was very much a used car. It only made right turns, so he couldn't turn left in it, which is a problem if you're driving. But it was his first car. It cost him $10. He didn't have any money. But you know what? Ford envisioned the car as the ultimate appliance. His favorite saying about the Model T was, it takes you there and it brings you back. And that's what my father, who was born in 1914, that's what he needed. And that's what he got when he got that Model T.
Now, before we get on to that second phase of Ford's career, as things began to go a bit sour for him, I want to just take a moment and appreciate the heights to which he'd advanced. As you put it, if he had passed away the day after announcing the $5 day, he would be remembered as one of the greatest men in history, and we would always wonder what he would have done next. But what would you say was the peak for the Ford Motor Company in that time in terms of its dominance in the market? As I heard, I think you said in 1921, it was 55% of the market, which is quite remarkable. Would that be its peak? What would that look like?
Yes. No, that would be it. He was dominant, and there was really no competition. General Motors was in virtual bankruptcy, just trying to, figure out how to get out of it. Pierre S. DuPont was running the company before he made Sloan the CEO. That was 1923. And it looked like he had cracked the code and that history was going to stop with his success. The 1920s were not a decade for Henry Ford. The 1920s were a decade of silent films. They were a decade of where large companies started giving people 2-week paid vacations, which was like revolutionary. The U.S. GDP was growing at a nice clip. And it was a decade of the beginning of leisure. Big sports became important. Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs for the New York Yankees in 1927. It was a new world. And Ford was still, in many ways, the farm boy who grew up on a farm in Dearborn. And, the person who he was competing against primarily was Alfred P. Sloan Jr., who was a trained engineer at MIT. And they were very different personalities. So I would say 1921 was the high point.
Got it. So at that point, Henry Ford, born in 1863, is 58 years old, which is already a pretty ripe old age for that era. But he goes on and lives for another 26 years.
He lives till 1947.
Yeah. So what happens over those 26 years? What brings about not the downfall of Henry Ford, because he did not, it's not as if the Ford family fell out of wealth and was reduced to living in penury, but what caused him to go from this iconic, universally beloved figure, somebody who was so dominant that people couldn't even imagine someone competing with him? By the way, an important lesson for people today who think, how could anyone ever compete with Facebook? How could anyone ever compete with Apple? Guess what? In 1921, people would have felt that way about Ford times 10.
That's absolutely true. And of course, Ford, you know, this was the, I'll state the obvious, the pre-software world. There was a gigantic plant that you could touch, feel, and kick, and which represented a hell of a lot of capital. And if you're gonna be a new entrant into this business, you better have a pretty good reason why someone is going to bankroll you and buy your product. The answer, I think, is that what Sloan said about Ford, what Alfred P. Sloan Jr. said about Ford, is that the old master failed to master change. And he did. He became more attached to the product and less cognizant of the fact that, at the end of the day, the Model T was a starter car. I sent you a chart, which is a wonderful chart, which I, unfortunately we can't, this isn't a visual, but it's a chart that was published, I think, in Motor Magazine in 1926. I mean, it was public knowledge that the strategy of first-time, of satisfying first-time buyers was coming to an end, that you needed to move from an appliance that takes you to place to, from place to place to a style item with a not insignificant fashion content. He was incapable of making that change. And someone told him, matter of fact, his son-in-law, Ernest Kanzler, wrote a long letter to him explaining, you know, Mr. Ford, we've got to make this change. And the result was Kanzler was fired, wound up working for General Motors. So, you know, I guess when you've done so much that nobody expected, and you're 64 or whatever, you know, however old he was when he brought out the Model A, which came out in 1928, it's awfully hard to get through to the guy. Also, he began to believe his own press notices, live in his own bubble. And in addition to everything else, and this really needs to be mentioned, it's the saddest, darkest chapter of a man who put America on wheels and really brings to the fore the question of, can people be both great and good? He was great in that accomplishment, but he was not good in that, for reasons which nobody really understands, and please believe me when I tell you there have been an enormous amount written about this, he became the most important anti-Semite in American history. He published booklets called The International Jew. He published a newspaper called The Dearborn Independent, which all his dealers had to stock. He republished something called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a fraud, but very anti-Semitic. And given his immense prestige, the Nazis, I mean, Hitler became chancellor on January 30th, 1933, and the guy who ran the Hitler Youth, a man named Walter von Schirach, at the Nuremberg trials in 1945, said, you have no idea what the impact of his book, Ford's The International Jew, had on German youth. And Ford is also the only American favorably mentioned in the American edition of Mein Kampf. As a matter of fact, I'm seeing if I can find the exact quote. Hitler talked about the struggle against international Jewish finance, and this is only strengthened the belief of the Nazi party that they should fight Jews. He asserted that Jews in Mein Kampf, that Jews were increasingly controlling masters of American labor. But then he says, this is a direct quote, "One great man, Ford, to their exasperation, still holds out independently." And in 1938, Ford accepted an award from the Nazi regime called the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, the Grand Cross of the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, which was the highest award the Reich, the Third Reich, could award a foreigner. And that was in 1938, and he accepted it, and the pictures of it still exist, of his being awarded this by the German consul in Detroit, and the consul, German consul in Cleveland was also there. So I can just tell you from personal memory that there were American Jews in the 1950s and the 1960s who would not buy a Ford for that reason, even though Henry Ford II, who was Henry Ford I's grandson, did what he could to erase that or to make up for anti-Semitism. Heaven only knows how much damage it did. And it was utterly unnecessary. And Ford, it started in the 1920s, in 1928 or 29, I can't remember which, he issued an apology and then went back to the same, doing the same kind of things in the 1930s. By the late 1930s, he had a couple of strokes, my recollection is, and by the early 1940s, he was still running the company. But as one biographer said, the years of the Mad Hatter had begun, anything could happen. And Henry Ford II was brought back in 1943 from the Navy because the government needed a Ford-run bomber plant called Willow Run to work, and it wasn't working, and Henry Ford, you know, couldn't manage it. And so Henry Ford II came back on the condition that Henry Ford I be pushed out of the company altogether. He was, and he lived for four more years, and so the ending is not a happy one, to put it mildly. And it was all so unnecessary, but this is history. This is what happened.
Well, again, I think it's important not to try to cover up the flaws that any person has, no matter how great. And clearly this was a major and confounding flaw because it did not even bring with it any particular gain. It wasn't as if he were cheating or doing something that gave him some sort of value. He was simply hating, which is just remarkable.
You put it very well. Let me just hesitate and pause here. You put it very well. It was all about hatred and what reason there was buried in him for this to come out. I really don't know.
Yeah, and I think it sounds like there's been a lot of scholarship on this, and no one knows.
Not.
And we'll never know up until the point that we have time machines that allow us to go into the past, which of course will be a big danger, because if once you have a time machine, everything becomes an endless battle to see who can either kill or save Hitler. But speaking about Ford, besides the hatred, the other problem was that inability to adapt to the times. And
yes,
this is something which is a theme that I've seen with a number of other blitzscalers. And it also speaks to one of the things that's so important that unfortunately Ford did not ultimately follow. And one of the principles we talk about briefly in the book is the importance of being an infinite learner, someone who realizes there's always more lessons to be learned, that the environment is always changing, and that the only way to continue successfully is to continuously seek to learn how things have changed and adapt. And in the case of Ford, he did exactly the opposite. He decided he had figured out the rules and was just going to stick with them because as long as he believed it hard enough, it was going to come true.
What is your view about founders as a company matures? Founders transforming themselves into managers? What have you observed out here in Silicon Valley or just in the world?
So I think that we've talked about how Steve Jobs had evolved, possibly because of the influence of Ed Catmull. There are other CEOs who have learned from people along the way as well, despite being, frankly, very proud, perhaps even haughty in nature, but being willing to learn from others. So I do think that it is possible for founders to successfully run companies for a long period of time. But it takes a special kind of founder. It takes the kind of founder who realizes that things are not right just because they believe them. And they have to be someone who sets out to figure out what is actually going to work and can take information from other sources. In the case of Steve Jobs, as we described, he learned from a very different kind of leader, Ed Catmull, but who helped him develop empathy that really served him well in the second half of his career as a leader. Some of the other folks that we talk about in the book, so for example, someone who is still early in his career, but I think we have a great deal of admiration for, is Brian Chesky, who is the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. He is packed into his relatively short life. He's in his early 30s now, quite a lot, and it's adding to that with this incredible crisis that the world is going through now, which has destroyed the travel industry. But yeah. I know that one of the things that Brian had always sought to do is he sought out mentorship and lessons from people wherever he could. And he would probably tell you that his greatest mentor was Walt Disney. He is an avid reader of Disney biographies, and he tries to extract lessons from them. But he would also, again, just reach out to people in the world. He would say, wow, with COVID-19, I need to figure out what we need to do to try to protect our guests and our hosts. And so he reached out to the former Surgeon General of the United States to get his help in figuring out how to actually solve the problems or how to best ameliorate the risks. So if you are, as a leader, even though you're the founder of the company, if you believe that you need to continually learn, that it is a growth mindset where you can always improve rather than a fixed mindset where I'm just inherently great, I'm just brilliant at everything because of who I am, then I think you can go and run that company for a long time very successfully. And in the case of Ford, ironically enough, even though he was an autodidact, someone who did so much learning, at some point in time, like you said, maybe he just began to really revel in his press clippings and the adulation and decided, you know what? I've already learned everything I need to know.
I think that was true of him. I would just like to hitchhike a little bit on what you just said, which I thought was very interesting. I think it also takes a special kind of founder to know when it's time to leave.
Yes.
And I would look at Bill Gates as, I think it was 2005, Chris, or maybe 2006, that he decided to step down as CEO of Microsoft and found the Gates Foundation. I think it was about 15 years ago. I may be wrong. But look at the great things that he's done in a whole another career. And I think that Robert Noyce, who's Intel employee number one, the same can be said of him. Certain founders sort of know when it's time to leave, and that's intriguing.
Yes, and the Bill Gates example is a fascinating one. And you're right, I just very quickly looked it up, and it was in 2006 that he transitioned away from being CEO of Microsoft, turned over the reins to his old friend Steve Ballmer. And at the time, Bill Gates was already obviously a legendary business figure. But today, people know him for his philanthropy. People, if anything, his approval rating has skyrocketed since his retirement from the world of business. And I think with good reason. He has done incredible things and impacted millions of lives. And the fact that he knew how to do that is quite remarkable. Because I would argue, looking at the early history of Bill Gates' career, there was no evidence that that was going to be the case.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I've read biographies of him, and if you had told me in 2000 that this was going to happen, I would have been very surprised to hear it. But he has managed to direct his, you know, remarkable intellect at a problem that heaven knows is bedeviling not only the United States terribly, but the whole world, and will be with us, I fear, for longer than any of us want. And already almost 100,000, or maybe now it is 100,000 Americans have lost their lives because of this disease. He, in a famous TED talk, warned about this in 2015, and now is working very hard to fix it. And this was a kind of wisdom that Henry Ford did not have. He was, he had a hammer and was convinced that the automobile industry was a nail, and it just wasn't. And so we didn't know when it was time to step off the stage. But I think this continuous learning, this is something that I hope that we will talk about Sam Walton. That was something that he did practice. So there are a wide variety of these people who are charismatic business leaders, but they wind up facing similar problems. What does it mean to be on top? How do you stay on top? How long do you stick around? How do you change when you think you've got a winning formula? I don't know.
And this really gets to something that I saw when I was writing Blitzscaling, which is basically those people who discover a formula, they have a set of traits which propel them to success. And they never stop to consider that perhaps those traits are only effective in a specific time and context. They think that the success is inherent in them as opposed to being based on the context around them. Two of the people that come to mind where this occurred pretty disastrously, if you think about Ken Olson, the founder of Digital Equipment Corporation, this was one of the premier technology companies in the United States in the 1970s and the early 1980s. And it's a company that created mini computers, a category that we don't even remember anymore, but was so critical. Did you use mini computers during your long career, Richard?
Believe you me, I remember this very well because one of the funders of the Digital Equipment Corporation was a professor at the Harvard Business School well before my time, named George Dorio. He founded a firm called American Research and Development, ARD, which was kind of a proto-venture capitalist firm. It was a closed-end thing. It was different. But he bet on Ken Olson and came out very well. And we had, at HPS, in Baker Library, on the right as you walked in through those big columns, it was all DEC. And DEC was all over the world. And the idea that in the course of one individual's life, the company would become, so important, and then not be able to change, even though it was built on change from the IBM 360 dominance. In many ways, he did to IBM what Sloan did to Ford,
Jobs did to him, and Jobs and Gates did to him what he had previously done to IBM.
Precisely. I mean, they created a revolution in miniature, and that's what we've got right now.
I think when we look at Jobs and Gates, by the way, two figures who will always be linked forever by both rivalry and ultimately friendship and cooperation. But think about how each of them was able to reinvent himself. Bill Gates reinventing himself from the CEO who was in many ways reviled and loathed for his hyper-competitive nature into perhaps the world's greatest philanthropist. And then Steve Jobs, who made his name building the personal computer, turning around and creating a company, Apple, which is really a consumer electronics company where the personal computer is a tiny fraction of its business.
Well, I'm aware of that. And, this is what you're describing is what Henry Ford was not able to do. Yeah. And now the company obviously survived. After 1945, say Ford, and Henry Ford the first died in 1947, but it was a buoyant market for American automobile manufacturers. Ford regained second place. It had lost second place in the U.S. Industry to Chrysler. Had an IPO in 1956, which was run by Goldman Sachs, which was a gesture by Henry Ford II to try to do something to make up for the, if that's the proper word, the anti-Semitism of his grandfather. Ford had a tremendous long run, but you tell me what's going to happen in the auto industry now. What Ford's place is in going to be, these are lively questions right at the moment. The Ford family, of course, is still very much involved in the Ford Motor Company. And I think it's the only family of which that can be said, a major car company today. So
I think that there are still families deeply involved in some of the overseas manufacturers. So, for example, the family that runs Volkswagen Porsche, for example. But I agree that in the United States, the Ford family is the only one where there is that kind of structure. I do think that
the Wallenberg family, also in Sweden, the Wallenberg family.
Of course.
Yeah. So I shouldn't have made that as a blanket statement. You're right.
Yep. But I do think that there is a way in which the family structure may ultimately prove to be a competitive advantage in the coming decades. And the reason is, I do think that we are staring down potentially existential changes to the automobile market. We have things like mobility, where perhaps in the future people will just use Uber or Lyft, or as I've predicted, that eventually on-demand ride-hailing is just included for free with your Amazon Prime account. And if that's the case, what exactly is the role of the traditional auto manufacturer? Yes, they can be a fab for just producing the cars, but will the branding still be there? Will they still exist in the form that we know them today? And one of the things about family ownership is when you have the ability to undertake longer term decisions without pressure, the same level of market pressure, and where you have the moral authority to make giant, sweeping, difficult decisions, you may have an advantage. Facebook is a fascinating example of this because Facebook has accomplished something that a lot of technology companies have not, which is to manage the transition from one platform to another. Facebook obviously arose during the era of the desktop computer, and it has maintained its preeminence even in a world which is now predominantly mobile. And the vast majority of web traffic, for example, is mobile. The majority of time spent on the internet is consumed by mobile devices. And Facebook was able to do that in part because of the incredible sway and moral authority of Mark Zuckerberg. When Facebook was going through this transition, he did two things that were very important. The first was that when Facebook had gone down the path, as it turns out, the wrong path of building Facebook's mobile presence around HTML5 instead of native apps on the iOS and Android platforms, Mark Zuckerberg said, we are going to freeze all feature development until we have native apps on iPhone and Android that are exactly as powerful as our desktop version. And for 2 years, they didn't do new feature development. They focused solely on this transition. And the second thing he did was he convinced the board. Actually, he just said he was going to do it. It's not like they could have stopped him. And he spent $22 billion buying WhatsApp and over $1 billion buying Instagram. Yeah. And both of those transactions, looking back on them now, are insane bargains. Yeah, where Zuckerberg was able to buy his way into dominance on the mobile platform. And that's something that would be difficult to do with a professional CEO with minimal ownership, attempting to convince shareholders and a board of directors, we need to invest $23 billion or we need to stop all feature development for 2 years.
Well, you make a strong case. I have to believe that Sheryl Sandberg has something to do with these decisions, but I she was with the company when these decisions were made, was she not?
Yes, she was, and I'm sure Sheryl played an important role. She was a student of yours, I take it.
Yeah, she was. What you're describing is the kind of flexibility that all companies need because the world is changing so fast. And who knows, Chris, what we're going to be facing on the other side of this terrible pandemic. Facebook, for example, I think has already announced that you can work from home kind of indefinitely if you're working for that company. Are other companies going to do the same? Is that going to be a competitive advantage? Who knows? Is that their version of the $5 day? We'll find out together.
I think it will be interesting. So to close things out, we've examined the life and career of Henry Ford. And it's, I think, so illustrative. So many important lessons came out of it that perhaps people who are not as familiar with business history would overlook. But what we saw with Henry Ford was the power of his core vision to put America on wheels, to create a car that would be accessible to all. And when he was carefully aligned, when that vision was aligned with the market, was aligned with the actions he was taking with the Ford Motor Company, he achieved the kind of success that was potentially unprecedented in the history of business, where he took control of what rapidly became the most important industry in the country with a level of dominance that really hasn't been seen since. And he achieved all of this in a remarkably short period of time, in just, I think we said, 13 years.
Yes.
That's truly amazing. And yet at the same time, it's a cautionary tale, because his inability to realize that the formula that led him to success was not necessarily a formula that would always work, and his inability to effectively bring in new management, to effectively delegate, to effectively pass on the torch, ultimately led to this long denouement, which harmed his reputation and harmed his business.
You put it very well. I mean, that's the story. It's the story of success followed by failure. And his life did not have a happy ending, but that's the way it worked out.
Well, unfortunately for Henry Ford, his life did not have a happy ending, but fortunately for us, hopefully we can learn from those mistakes and avoid them in our own lives. And the same will be true for the people who are listening in. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule for this. I know I'm looking forward to more of these conversations in the future.
Well, as always, it's my pleasure, and I look forward to further conversations very much as well.